the National Archives podcast series. Highlights of the Security Service files released at the National Archives. Presented by Christopher Andrew.
The latest six-monthly release at the National Archives of formerly top-secret MI5 documents includes one of the most important groups of early Cold War intelligence files to be declassified. These are the post-war diaries of Guy Liddell, wartime head of counterespionage who became Deputy Director General of MI5 from 1946 to 1952. Most of his colleagues later remembered him with affection and admiration. Even Kim Philby, the Soviet mole inside MI6, British Foreign Intelligence, had a good word for Liddell when he came to write his memoirs after fleeing to Moscow. Liddell, Philby recalls, was, quote, an ideal senior officer for a young man to learn from. He would murmur his thoughts aloud, as if groping his way towards the facts of the case, his face creased in a comfortable, innocent smile. But behind the facade of laziness, his subtle and reflective mind played over a storehouse of photographic memories. Liddell also had a high opinion of Philby until evidence of Philby's treachery began to emerge in 1951. One of many revelations in Liddell's diaries is that in 1950, when Philby was MI6 representative in Washington, he tried to persuade Liddell to appoint him MI5 representative as well. Mercifully for MI5, Liddell did not rise to the bait. Liddell's World War II diaries have been available at the National Archives for some years, and much of their contents have been published. His early Cold War diaries, most of which have just been declassified, are even more important because, as Deputy Director General, his responsibilities covered a wider area of MI5 operations than in wartime. As well as providing new information on these operations, Liddell also brings dramatically to life the intelligence tensions of the early Cold War. One of the tensest moments was the discovery in 1949 that the Soviet Union had secretly tested its first atomic bomb 2 years earlier than British and US intelligence had expected. Liddell describes how the discovery was announced to the Joint Intelligence Committee with what he considered melodramatic secrecy by its Foreign Office chairman, Sir William Hayter. Quote, Hayter cleared the room of secretaries and then said if there was anyone present who could not keep what was going to be said to himself, would he kindly leave the room? The announcement which followed of the Soviet atomic test was made all the more dramatic by the almost simultaneous discovery that one of the two main atom spies who had betrayed secrets to Moscow of the construction of the first American atomic bomb was the German-born British physicist Klaus Fuchs. Finding evidence to secure Fuchs's conviction proved immensely difficult. Liddell's diary reveals that though MI5 surveillance revealed a good deal about Fuchs's private life, including an affair with the wife of his line manager, it provided no proof of espionage. In the end, to Liddell's relief, patient questioning by MI5's chief interrogator persuaded Fuchs to make a confession without which he would probably never have been convicted. The intelligence which revealed that the Soviet Union had become a nuclear power marked a major turning point in British foreign and defense policy. Soviet atomic weapons, wrote Liddell on New Year's Day 1950, had, quote, thrown everyone's calculations out of date. He forecast that within 7 years, quote, the Russians should have sufficient atomic bombs to blot this country out entirely. The Liddell diaries are of major importance for the history not simply of British intelligence, but also of the post-war Labour government led by Clement Attlee. Many historians of the Attlee era may be surprised to discover that is, at his own request, he had far more private meetings with the Director General of MI5 than any other British Prime Minister. The post-war DG, Sir Percy Sillitoe, told Attlee in 1949 that MI5 now had, quote, quite a number of agents in the Communist Party who are well-placed and give us good coverage. The Prime Minister, noted Little in his diary, seemed particularly pleased about this. When Sillitoe was abroad on one of his numerous tours to inspect Imperial security, Little met Attlee instead. Though the two men shared a mutual respect, Little was disconcerted by the Prime Minister's taciturn manner. Quote, "You say your piece, and when you come to the end, there's a long pause. You then begin the next item on the agenda. I think it's to some extent due to a curious shyness which he radiates and indeed imparts to others. He doesn't often look you in the face." One of Attlee's main reasons for summoning Sillitoe and Little to No. 10 so frequently was his fear of communist penetration of the Labour Party, particularly in the Commons. At one of his first meetings with Little, he asked to be informed whenever MI5 had, quote, "positive information that a Member of Parliament was a member of a subversive organisation." Attlee, for his part, provided MI5 with a list of those he believed were communist fellow travellers in the Labour Party. He told Little in 1947 that he was certain that the well-known Labour MP, Stephen Swingler, among others, was a secret member of the Communist Party. Though such concerns may nowadays seem alarmist, they continued intermittently until the early 1960s. My authorised history of MI5 reproduces a list sent by Attlee's successor, Hugh Gaitskell, and other Labour leaders to MI5 in 1961, listing 16 Labour MPs who they believed were undeclared members of the Communist Party, as well as another 9 possible members. Though Attlee was kept well informed by MI5, Little preferred to keep most other ministers at arm's length. He wrote dismissively in 1950, quote, "Intelligence matters were usually of such complexity that the less ministers had to do with them, the better. It was far better to get things settled, if possible, on a lower level. Ministers had not really got the time to go into all the details. If, therefore, they were required to make a decision, it's as likely as not that it would be the wrong one." Probably with Attlee's approval, the head of the civil service, the cabinet secretary, and the Home Office permanent undersecretary were each far better informed about the security service than most members of the cabinet. Scattered through Little's diaries are entries of considerable interest to historians of British decolonisation, as well as of domestic policies. It's been little noticed, for example, that MI5 played an important advisory role during the emergency in Malaya. On the eve of the emergency, however, Little was deeply suspicious of the head of the Malayan Security Service, John Daly. He noted in his diary that there was, quote, "a strong indication that if, as we intend to do, we put in an informant in the Malayan Communist Party, Daly will sabotage him." Little's comments on Daly are one example of how frankly he expressed himself in diaries which he never imagined would ever see the light of day. On several occasions when writing about black Africans, he uses the N-word, something he would not have done in an official document or internal minute. Like many in Whitehall at the beginning of the 1950s, he regarded the peoples of Britain's African colonies as, quote, "wholly unfitted for self-rule." Unlike some in the colonial office, however, Little did not exaggerate communist influence on the leaders of the independence movements in West and East Africa, Kwame Nkrumah and Jomo Kenyatta, partly because of comments on both overheard by MI5 in bugged conversations at British Communist Party headquarters, though that isn't spelt out in the diaries. While Little's diaries are the most important item in the current release at the National Archives, there are also a series of revealing files on individuals investigated by MI5. The most detailed is the 10-volume file on one of Britain's leading communist journalists, Sam Lesser, also known as Sam Russell, which covers his career from his years as a student communist and volunteer for the international brigades in the Spanish Civil War during the 1930s to daily worker, foreign correspondent, and foreign editor at the height of the Cold War in the early 1960s. While Lesser was the Communist Daily Worker's Moscow correspondent from 1955 to 1959, he became a friend of the former British diplomat and Soviet agent Donald MacLean, who for 15 years had provided the KGB with so many classified Foreign Office documents that Moscow found difficulty in translating them all. Lesser's lengthy file provides interesting detail on MI5's surveillance methods, ranging from the interception of his correspondence to eavesdropping at the British Communist Party's London headquarters. Some of the files in the latest release are only a fraction the size of Lesser's, but nonetheless fill in significant details of the careers of their subjects. One example is the file on the fanatical Swiss anti-Semite François Genoux, who was believed to have worked for the Abwehr, German foreign intelligence, during World War II. Genoux emerged from the war as an unrepentant Nazi and, allegedly, Hitler's as well as Goebbels' literary executor. Other sources show that Genoux devoted much of his post-war energies to assisting Nazi war criminals escape justice. Among the fragmentary files in the latest release, which add interestingly to declassified documents already in the National Archives, is Volume 2 of the file on Sefton Delmer, a wartime pioneer of black propaganda against Nazi Germany. The first volume of his file has been in the National Archives for some years. Volume 2 reveals that in the mid-1950s, Delmer, then chief foreign affairs reporter for the Daily Express, fell under some suspicion because of his friendship with Otto Jahn, first head of the security service of the West German Federal Republic. In 1954, Jahn apparently defected to East Germany, though he later reappeared in the West, claiming he had been kidnapped. Sefton Delmer arranged for the serialization of Jahn's memoirs in the Daily Express. His file comments disapprovingly that, quote, although Delmer may not be a communist, he certainly writes like one. In addition to MI5 files on individuals, the latest release includes 9 volumes of intercepted communications during the later 1930s from the Italian embassy in London to a military intelligence department in Rome. These reveal details of Italian attempts to obtain classified information on the British armed services, sometimes in collaboration with German intelligence. Though somewhat complex, the intercepts are an important source for historians researching Italian-British relations before the Second World War. Unsurprisingly, some mysteries remain in the latest batch of MI5 files. Chief among them is the fate of Henry Boryński, a Polish priest in a Catholic parish in Bradford who disappeared without trace in 1953. Because of widely publicized claims that Boryński had been abducted by Soviet or Polish intelligence, MI5 had some involvement in the investigation. At one point, a self-proclaimed Soviet assassin was reported to have poisoned Boryński with cyanide, then buried his body on instructions from Moscow. The story, however, seems to have been fabricated, though the KGB did carry out some assassinations on the continent in the 1950s and attempted others, it's highly unlikely to have been involved in Boryński's disappearance. Over half a century later, the mystery remains unsolved. As usual, there's a very helpful National Archives introduction, complete with file references, to the latest MI5 release. This release brings the total numbers of volumes of declassified MI5 files in the National Archives to almost 5,000, of which the most recent go up to 1962. Over the last decade, they've inspired a growing number of graduate theses, articles, and books, recently including Ben McIntyre's 3 bestsellers on the Double Cross system. Their significance extends far beyond the history of MI5. They contain important insights into the way British prime ministers from Asquith to Macmillan used or didn't use intelligence, a major topic sometimes ignored by their biographers. Imperial and gender historians, among others, will also find from time to time fresh insights in the KGB series. The files on individuals, even when MI5 concluded they posed no security risk, sometimes reveal new biographical material. The KV series of MI5 files in the National Archives thus continues to set a large and growing research agenda.
This podcast was recorded at the National Archives in Kew on October the 10th, 2012. This podcast is copyright the National Archives, all rights reserved.